there. Yeah, you would think after all these years I'd be able to use this machine a little bit more, with a little bit more grace and style, but it's not ever going to happen. This is our third session, and we are, well, I guess you were a little disappointed to find out that you hadn't gotten farther along, but you're just starting your graduate career. Actually, and maybe you seemed a little, reluctant to talk about it all. You really just didn't know, but you had also applied for this history of science thing, program, and you just didn't even get to a level or to a point. They just kind of flat out said, don't bother, or we're not interested. And your explanation was that what you wrote, everybody has to write this kind of why I want to go to grad school in, was naive. And actually, I kind of pushed you to talk about it a little more, and you didn't seem interested in doing so or willing. But I'm more curious about getting some information about these history of science programs at Cornell and Harvard. You applied? No, Cornell and
Harvard.
Right, especially of course the Cornell one, because it's such a, it has such a reputation, and it has a reputation, depending on who you are, as a very, very wonderful program, or as a very, very awful program. So I was actually more curious about
the reputation of Cornell.
It just is very kind of dogmatic in its approach and run by one person. That's the negative side. I won't pretend that I'm not all that. And then there's the other side, that it's very, it's almost like a scientific program. That's why it's so wonderful.
This was 20 years ago. And
that's when this guy was starting to run it.
Well, I mean, I wrote an essay.
Okay.
And
you just thought it was...
And, my application went in. People wrote recommendations. I mean, I have no idea why rejected my application. They don't write you a letter saying...
No, well...
Why?
Mm-hmm. But we had also discussed, you had a pretty good, background, and you certainly had no problem getting into a chem program at something like MIT, and getting a Danforth scholarship, which you could have used for anything, right? I mean, you could have gone to study, restoration literature, so it does seem a little strange, unless you wrote this really bizarre proposal or something.
I don't have a copy of it.
Okay, well, I just thought I would try, and I won't push it any further.
We'll
erase this part. No.
Well, I mean, I think also by the time I had to make a decision about what I was going to do, it was really clear that science was more interesting and would keep me up late at night, whereas history was more one step removed from what I wanted to do.
It's not the doing of it itself, it's the looking at the doing of things, right?
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Which some of us are better suited for, perhaps, than others. I guess I've also kind of stressed that part because I don't think it's really that... it's not even a question of being common or uncommon. I don't think most practicing scientists get into science or develop an appreciation for science the way you did, which at a place like UCSC was really from that.
Well, it was tolerated there. And my undergraduate research advisor tolerated it, and my political science professors encouraged it.
Right. It was almost as if you could learn what they had to say about science as a part of culture or something by doing it yourself and that sort of thing. And, so that's a unique, at least so far as I know, I'm still kind of at the beginning of this with people approach or background to your eventually going into science, and that you went so far as before your experience in Detroit to really actually go the other way. It's almost as if it's clear that you have some sense of you are one of those people who, while maybe you like the doing of it, you still always have this perspective of being interested or curious about how it's done, this one step removed that you mentioned.
Yeah, but, frankly, that's not... I use the word encouraged, but it's not tolerated within science.
No, not until you are 80 years old, and then you can write about your history and all the great things you did.
But then it's boring.
Well, some of it's boring, but actually some can be pretty good. I'm trying to think of a good example, and actually one doesn't come to mind.
Well, I mean, a famous example is the double helix.
Right. Well, that's propaganda. Well, I guess I shouldn't be expressing my
own
opinions.
Well, I mean, isn't it all?
I don't know. I think some people really have made some effort to try to, and his name escapes me, and he's a biochemist who's really, this is the second time I've done this, which is almost unhelpful on tape not to have the man's name. He's done a lot of publishing, actually, in the proceedings of the New York Academy of Science on the history of biochemistry, and actually he's got a two-volume thing where he's got historians of science and scientists themselves who are involved in these events to write. And there's some, you know, that's not tooting one's own horn or kind of doing this is how it happened sort of imminent thing from on high of, you know, very much like how they perceive, I think, science as being done, right? It's there to be discovered, and this is how we discovered it. Well, it's kind of got a beginning, a middle, and an end point, right, mm-hmm. with no context, if you will. It could be completely done out of context, as a matter of fact. I guess I think of Kornberg's kind of autobiography, in which it's that kind of position is done. So,
yeah. And Luria's memoir, for example, I read. And I'm not sure really what function these sorts of books serve. I mean, maybe people read them and get inspired or not.
You know. I know from my perspective they usually have enough information in them that I use them for the sheer gathering of, you know, of information. They have facts about what they did, mm-hmm. and often you don't read it with I read it at a cross purpose as to why they're writing it, I think. Whereas I think these oral histories are actually done in an attempt to kind of correct for that, right? We're very clear about what we'd like to talk about and making it kind of, or trying to make it collaborative. So that there's some attempt, I think, to move away from, well, this is my discovery and this is how it happened, sort of thing. I've run into a few times people expressing to me, well, you know, how are you gathering this data and what's your, you know, mm-hmm. your objective criteria and how did, well, you know, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. it's like, you know, that's not what this is about. We're mm-hmm. not conducting mm-hmm. some sort of experiment, so... I have, you know, kind of lead them away from that and to make it a subjective kind of discussion and conversation. Mm-hmm.
Well, as far as my own relationship to the history of science or politics of science, I don't read extensively in that anymore.
Yeah.
And part of that break happened in graduate school for sure, and part of it was I walked into my first year advisor's office, having looked at the catalog, and there was a course at MIT on science and the law, and there was a course on, you know, some other aspect of, you know, social implications of science, and I basically had this idea that graduate school would be just an extension of my undergraduate training, you know, I'd just be able to go and keep thinking and... you know, and I had met other people. There was a physicist at UC San Diego who was getting a PhD in physics, but also did a lot of reading and in historical aspects mm-hmm. of science. And so here was a person I knew. I thought, oh, look, people actually do this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And I walked into my advisor's office with this curriculum planned out, and he said, you're taking A, B, and C. Do you have any questions? You know, micro and biochemistry and
then
genetics.
You're working, you know, 50 hours a week
well,
in this lab.
Well, that's an interesting thing about MIT, about the MIT graduate program in biology, which is, it's almost bizarre, considering the style of the institute. The MIT program in biology, the students to this day don't do these rotations in their first year. And in fact, they're supposed to be completely out of the lab in the first year. In general, the students have had some lab experience. And so you get all these people, they're smart, they're ready to go, win Nobel Prizes in their rotation projects, you know. And then you tell them, forget it. Yeah, you don't know enough. Okay, so maybe that's part of it. You know. But part of it is emphasizing scholarship. And part of it is that what this does, you take classes for the first year. And what that does is it gives people the intellectual opportunity to break with what they've done as undergraduates. And you get a certain amount of breadth and appreciation for different types of logic in different parts of biology. And so by the time people choose their thesis topics or thesis advisors, the students, we knew a lot more than when we started about a lot of different things. And so, you know, it was conceivable that someone with a chemical or physical background might go into genetics, or someone with a genetic background might go into biochemistry or something. And at the same time, you know, it really emphasized that there was a body of knowledge that you had to become familiar with and learn how to become familiar with to basically do science,
mm-hmm.
Do your work. And then that third component really was, there was a particular course called Logic and Methods in Molecular Biology, which was a course where people read the literature, and we met once a week. And
the current literature, I mean.
Yeah, the current literature, and sort of cowered.
Not the classics or something like that.
Well,
both, maybe.
I remember a genetics course with Ethan Signer where we read classic papers in genetics up to modern papers.
Sure.
But the course on logic and methods was modern papers, 3 a week. And the year that I took it, it was just a withering barrage of questions and complexities and
I mean the papers
issues.
Themselves were
well the papers were but also the questions that the two faculty that ran the course mm-hmm.
who were they
asked Phil Sharp and Malcolm Gefter mm-hmm. It was a course about methods, it was a course about reading, it was a course about how you actually prove something, prove a model from many different angles,
mm-hmm.
and the emphasis was that, you know, one experiment is sort of weak. And the question was, how do you really know something?
Mm-hmm.
So we read papers that were right, we read papers that were wrong, we read papers that were inconclusive, and we learned that Phil and Malcolm were extremely sophisticated about how they read them compared to, well,
right,
I learned how I read them. Yeah,
I've gone to a few journal club type group meetings and just been kind of, you know, walked out numbed and shocked. And these are, you know, just kind of informal gatherings where people pick apart, you know, work in their own field. So, I mean, they even have a much different, the thing is not just some sort of intellectual exercise. It's also, you know, where's this stuff going? What can we, you know, get out of it? How do we critique the work of this lab who's
yeah.
either a competitor or doing something similar or got some interesting new technique that we might want to, you know, learn real fast, that sort of thing. But it's amazing that I read them so very at a level of naivete. I
mm-hmm.
think that's just
maybe a model would be something like a business school where people read and study successful quote-unquote corporations
mm-hmm.
and learn how to do management
mm-hmm.
by studying real case study sort of.
Right.
So this was case studies where you weren't talking about your own work or dealing with your own work. You were dealing with sort of the current literature in that way.
Do you know that? Do you know if this was a long tradition in MIT to do it this way?
Yeah. It's still going on. Okay. Like I have an undergraduate student.
Is here for the summer or something?
No, she was in my lab in Salt Lake as an undergraduate and went to MIT as a graduate student and took that course.
And so here. Is it still being taught by the same two?
No. It varies, and in fact, it was maybe 2 years after my class went through it. The graduate students sort of rebelled. They got really pissed off at how hostile this course is.
You meant that the
or was.
It was just so hard. It was kind of like the boot camp. No matter who was teaching it, it was meant to just make it a struggle.
There was a good cop, bad cop scene. And it was
you mean like one of the professors was the good cop and one was the
really?
Absolutely. Even if it was not just Gifter and Sharp, it was other people.
It tended to be very adversarial.
Wow.
And the graduate students took a poll and decided that the course should not be taken without permission of parent or guardian. It was, that bad. I mean, it was a great course, but it was also very
grueling,
rough.
And it was 3 times a week, you said? No, 3 papers
a week.
For like 5 hours or something, right?
Yeah. And, it was partly justified. The philosophy in the graduate program was that the admissions committee never makes a mistake. And they tell you this up front, which is sort of weird because everybody gets in there and the first day you're looking around the room going, gee, what am I doing here? Everybody else is so smart. But this course, I had an experience where I think it was the second or third night. It met at night and let up about 10 or something like that. And it was just so...
It met at 10 p.m.?
Well, it finished around
10. Oh, okay. This was boot camp. Wait a second.
Oh, God, yeah. But I was, so agitated about it. I wasn't paying attention. I was walking to the subway, and these junior high school kids tried to mug me. And they just picked on the wrong guy, because I was, like, ready to explode.
Yeah.
So I managed to get away, but I was like, maybe I should credit the course.
Saving you $10 in your wallet.
Exactly.
Oh, God. I guess I was asking also about the particulars of who and whether it's still going on and that sort of thing for two reasons. It seems that it would, considering the quality of MIT graduate students and the consistency, let's say, and I'm not saying there aren't equally, powerhouse-type institutions when it comes to biology and biochem and genetics. You'd think other schools would pick up on this process of... It almost seems like it's also all of you. The first year you show up, you're all stuck in the
Everybody's
same class. You have to deal with everybody. It's almost like they're setting this off. It is intellectual boot camp. I hate to keep coming back to the same image, but do you have a sense from your other experiences, for instance, having grad students yourself, I would assume at both Utah and here, why that's not... would you like to see something like that instituted here? Would you think about running something like that?
Oh, no. There are reading courses
required
in all the graduate programs I've
for a first year
been associated with. First year, right, Utah, Oregon, here.
You mean you've taught some of them or purchased?
I've taught. I taught one in Utah.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't taught one here yet.
I take it it's time consuming, or?
It
depends on who you are.
Not really. Mm. It's not. Because it's time consuming to choose the papers. And usually it's papers, like when I taught a course like this, most of the papers I had already read. So it just required that I... sort of refresh my memory about them.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, the the type, the whole style of the course I taught was completely different. It was the students made presentations rather than faculty just asking questions.
Okay. And this was your, I mean, this was the way it was done at Utah, so you did it this way, or this was the way that you did it?
No, I guess my feeling was that students at Utah wouldn't put up with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and obviously, I don't mean to also suggest it has to be done this way.
Yeah, I mean,
you know?
I don't think it's the best style myself. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think you can be careful and critical and sophisticated or
tough, even in the intellectual sense of requiring concentration and thinking. And maybe, as you said, you were agitated. It seems more of the psychological aspect of the class as opposed to having the headache or the kind of that knot in your brain from having to think really hard, which is another kind of stress or whatever. This reaction in the subway sort of thing is much more about nerves and psyche and other things, it seems, than just...
No, I mean, people would break down crying in the class if they, you know...
It was like these law school, the myth of law school, right?
They didn't know, and then bam, you know, all of a sudden somebody's crying. And we didn't...
Really men and women. Men in tears as well as women, or do you think it was more of a... I don't... That's not meant to be a sexist question or a gender-type question, but just curious.
It happened a couple times. The time I remember a person crying was a woman, but also there was a woman who got driven to the same point and told the faculty to fuck off.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, quote, unquote.
In class.
Mm-hmm. Like, you know, go, oh, fuck off.
Yeah. That's great.
So, I mean... People have different responses, but it wasn't anything I wanted to get into in my own class, right?
Right.
And so I felt like there are ways to let students know that you can take any area and just go deeper and deeper and deeper into it, you know, that you don't get it in the first reading or your first approach to something. Without making them feel like they're worthless.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I appreciate the sort of sense of craft, you know, almost like dance or something, that this course, and in fact that the program at MIT inculcated in people, but I didn't appreciate the sort of roughness of the institute.
Do you think it was kind of a time that this program was especially effective too? I mean, that it was maybe Gifter and Sharp, or it really is the program and the institution itself is something that carries forward this, no matter who's doing this, it's going to still be kind of done with this rough and ready kind of fashion, and that's MIT biology, regardless of who does it. And
no, this particular course, I mean, I know from talking to my student that it, you know, is much less... hostile right now, but
just
it's still effective.
Okay.
And the real content or the common thread here is that the program at MIT was really oriented toward teaching students to do science rather than getting students to pick it up by osmosis. By putting students in a place where science is happening and expecting
to make it a conscious,
they will get it, or accepting the students that get it and writing off the students that don't get it. I mean, there wasn't a student that was allowed to not get it.
Mm-hmm. And was there a large? I mean, did that class? Did you see it for the first year? Like. You came back, or, you know, you started the rotations of the next year or whatever, and there were, like, half of you left, or was it really slower process of elimination?
No, that was the point, is that there wasn't a process of elimination.
Basically, everybody got out of that class getting it, except maybe for one or two who just, you know, jumped into the, to the Charles River.
Well, that's happened, right?
I mean,
you read Natural Obsessions,
yeah.
You should read this book.
Which one is this? No.
It's Natalie Angier.
Oh, okay.
On the discovery of oncogenes in Weinberg's lab. And some of the science is odd, and some of the stories of how ideas came about are more romantic than real. But the sense of competition and what the sociology of MIT in the early 80s mm-hmm. there is captured really well,
you think?
By the book, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I will look at it.
But the only people I know actually that were thrown out of the graduate program got caught in something, you know, basically dark. There was a student who was publicly vocal about caution in recombinant DNA research, and after 6 years she was required to write a special exam, and she failed it and was asked to leave the program.
You mean this was like a setup then to get rid of her or something?
Well, it certainly could have been viewed that way. I mean, by the same token, if she had been a star and cruised through this exam, she would have survived. But it was definitely a special thing that was done
because
to
she
her.
Was vocal about.
Well, you know, I don't know.
You just knew she was vocal about something,
yeah,
and she was out.
Yeah, I don't
was
know.
Was she like the only one asked to take this?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The only one you ever knew,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
How strange. A written kind of exam by her own chair. I mean, by her.
Well, her thesis advisor was Luria, and he certainly participated in this, yeah. And there was another student who was a student from physics who had his thesis committee was three physicists and two biologists, or two physicists and three biologists, and he got all the way into his defense, and the physicist apparently had some axe to grind that biology wasn't rigorous, and so they started into him, and his thesis advisor decided that he could show the physicist that biology was as rigorous as physics, so he
was like the
went
crucible.
After his own student in the last exam, boom.
Just left the program.
No, that was another sort of pathology. Is you can imagine what this would be like going through this. You know, it's just horrendous.
To kind of watch it happen.
You think you're finished, right? You go into the exam, and your
the object of other people's
is like hammering what you've done. And the I would have, you know, really caved, but this person was back in the lab the next week, and he worked for another year to clean up all the loose ends, and he finished. He ended up finishing, but it was a very painful
mm-hmm.
sort of thing.
Success. Somebody who's gone on and stayed in science?
I haven't followed his work at all.
Maybe somebody you still knew or
a
friend or something. I wasn't looking for so much of a name, but just a turnout.
No, but I mean, by and large, people finished, and the expectation was that you'd finish. It's that particular program was not one that anybody, you know, ever expected to fail mm-hmm. out of, and so they just said, "Look, it's tough, but we're not going to fail you. So just do it."
Yeah. Mm. What else was there about the, you know, it was all just coursework in the first year. I mean, I assume you also knew this, right? You went in knowing MIT was going to be different about this.
Well, I mean, you know it's coursework, but you don't know
really the other...
the atmosphere. You know, it was a time when, like I mentioned, recombinant DNA technology was just coming on.
Especially
and there was a lot of hostility on the faculty. Different people who had been friends who weren't on speaking terms anymore because they ended up on different sides of the regulatory issue. And
do you know what kind of was the splitting issue? I mean, you know, why some people, was it people who weren't using or intending to use or thought that they would never really need that kind of technology who were worried about its consequences versus those who were, or did everybody know that we were all going to use it? And I mean, I guess I see some biochemists as not, you know.
Sure, I mean, the people that had less direct, immediate
need
for it were much more cautious. But, you know, it wasn't exclusively that way. And I would say that many of those people use it now.
Sure.
You know. I mean,
Well, it was enough of a controversy that it involved students, and I don't mean in the sense that you were all asked to take a side or something like that, but it was a discussable kind of thing, right?
Oh,
I mean,
it wasn't some sort of
backroom meetings between, different faculty because they were sitting on, somebody was being, you know, representing MIT or something at some governmental type hearing. I mean, I assume there was a lot of politics involved in this as well.
And public hearings in the Cambridge City Council and, you know,
I mean, local, state, federal, I mean, all of them.
Yeah.
Was it something that you, I mean, again, given your kind of background of being conscious more of these kinds of things, like how politics affects science or how science is, you know, has a context of its social, you know, the people who do it and stuff like that. Was it something you were involved in, either directly or just watched keenly and with interest? Or?
Yeah, I was involved. I mean, I think it was a central thing in biology.
Would you, you know, I actually have had not much success with people, you know, so far talking about it. And really, I feel that the further we get along with the other scholars, the less and less that, you know, they come into a situation where it's pretty much settled or where the burning issues of an unknown technology have kind of started to be answered as people do it more and more. So I was wondering if perhaps you would be willing to kind of, you know, outline some of what you were involved in, or, you know, some of the things you remember as like, I don't know, some heated meeting at a Cambridge, like you said, Cambridge City Council meeting, some paper you helped draft. I mean, I don't know. I don't mean to put parameters on it either.
Well, I guess, you know, there were meetings about what was being done and what the experiments on safety, what experiments would give you information about how safe the technology would be. There were I got involved with a friend who worked at the Natural Resources Defense Council in New York in commenting on NIH guidelines as they came out.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing was, it wasn't really my field, you know. Microbial genetics was not my field. I came from a chemistry background.
Right.
But, you know, at one point I wrote a library survey of, a literature survey of essentially what was not known. What was known and what was not known. So, it was based on or centered around comments on suggested changes in the NIH guidelines.
Okay. And those comments were?
Went to the NRDC. Who sent them to NIH, or who rewrote them. They rewrote them.
The NIH ended up rewriting them.
No, the NRDC
rewrote your stuff. Okay, I
took material, you know, it was like they just read the paper and took the parts out that they wanted, and they put it in whatever language they wanted.
Do you know what your, I mean, it was, like you said, mainly a literature survey or whatnot, right? I mean, of what had already been done in the sense of control kind of experiments and ways of checking it. And what was your sense? Was it, were you, would you say you were on the conservative side, or were you on the other side? Or
Well, I was sort of impressed with how little was known about movement of DNA between organisms. And
just regular sorts of, let's say, you know, natural recombination.
Yeah, in a way. And so there were lots of claims made that making certain genetic constructions would be, you know, completely safe. And they were, many of the claims were based on
nothing.
On people's opinions, yeah, basically. And there were even, you know, experiments at the time that showed that dimers of viral DNAs could actually lead to infection if they were injected.
Sure.
Whereas the monomers weren't. And so the conclusion of the paper, of course, was that people construct monomers and therefore this is going to be safe. But of course, anybody who's ever done a plasmid prep knows that you always get dimers as a contaminant or as a byproduct or as a small second product.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, it was a time when people just wanted to get into the research using this new technique.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly a lot of companies were springing up at the time. And there hadn't been a great deal of work on whether the organisms would be safe or mm-hmm. or how they might spread.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think in the event nobody's died from mm-hmm. recombinant DNA technology, and that's what people were really worried about mm-hmm. back then. You know, would these genetic constructions kill people?
Or become, I even suppose, more virulent. I mean, wasn't, I guess, an issue, seems to me, a question of, given what we know about viral replication, aren't we talking about perhaps creating situations where that replication is just, you know, incredibly powerful and
well, you change the host range of a virus or yeah. viral sequence. Or
sure, and you should just... Yeah. Not even necessarily, a plague of death upon everybody, but just a viral, you know, that everybody got all of a sudden that was harder to transmit before or something like that, right? I mean, they just weren't. I mean, I still think about the kind of the unknowns in viral replication, right? And kind of wonder about when. Why do you think it is that nothing like that has happened? I mean, given the. Given the way that viruses naturally spread, isn't it almost. Amazing that you haven't seen at least one lab kind of go down the tubes with people. Do you think it's just controls on how experiments are done and that they, like any controlled situation in a lab that deals with, you know, isotopes and other dangerous materials, that everybody's just careful enough in that?
People are careful, but, you know, there are always accidents, and probably the answer is that these... To the extent that organisms are dangerous or proteins are dangerous, they just they don't get spread when you clone them into bacteria. When
sure.
you clone the genes into bacteria, they don't.
I mean, I think of, you know, the use of HIV, right? I mean, again, with a certain kind of controls and the notices, like, you know, this room has, you know, that obviously people, there's, as far as I know, no reports in lab situations. Certainly there may be with healthcare workers and needle sticks and whatnot, but there's certainly no case of infection with the virus in a lab now that uses HIV, at least not that I've heard.
HIV. But people, I mean, I think if you ask virologists, or I've asked virologists, do you know anybody who got sick from the subject
right.
of their work? And, you know, many times you're talking to people who worked on characterizing viruses that had unknown properties and they were discovered by accident or whatever. And sometimes you hear people say, well, they don't know, maybe.
Well, I was really sick with this weird thing.
Yeah, I had this weird thing once, and maybe that was... Yeah. But they never chased it down.
Or found out that their children and their next-door neighbors and all got the same illness.
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Or, you know, in X-ray crystallography, in my area now, we're dealing with X-rays. And
oh, yeah.
And so... you know, there's the story of so-and-so who got stomach cancer or whatever.
Overexposed.
Because of exposure. I mean, Curie died.
Exposure. Galileo, like, went blind and,
So it's
a common
theme.
These
things happen, but the, direct causative links are often not what searched for.
I take it, you know, like with the isotopes, with the x-rays, there's just certain precautions and rules that one follows, and they're pretty rigorously checked in any...
Oh, yeah, and it, you get trained not and to you put your finger in the x-ray beam, basically.
And just keep me away from all that stuff, thank you, because I've been known to knock over a whole tray of beakers just walking through a room.
Yeah, but, you know, you have monitors.
Right, I don't know, sure.
Safe procedures.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that you felt that the controls were, and the kind of the resolution of the issue back then of recombinant DNA was to your satisfaction? I mean, do you feel that the process was good as a scientist then? In other words, without the hindsight,
was the process good? No, the process was horrendous. Come on, it was an education in sort of politics. You know, was how many Nobel laureates could you get on your side and
to kind of like get the NIH to take up that position?
Right.
Who was head of the NIH then?
Fredrickson.
Okay.
People were had commercial interests and conflicts of interest because they wanted to develop commercial applications, and you could see this very plainly, and yet they were taking public stands as supposedly expert scientists.
And meanwhile they were working for a pharmaceutical company or starting
their own or whatever, you know, and that's
dishonest.
Well, it's
conflict of interest.
There's a conflict of interest there, and you can find a lot of those still going on, but it doesn't, change the way the
world
is.
You mean people who are involving themselves as experts in discussions about protocols or rules or regulations, kind of having an ulterior...
Yeah.
I think it's a very common situation in the insurance companies now that they perceive that the Clinton administration is going to... go at them, suggest that they've not been included in the process, right? That if anybody should know about healthcare delivery, it's insurance companies, and why aren't we being asked to participate in the process? And we're being left out.
But, I mean, in some ways, that's the way the world works, is you have advocates
for
new technologies, and they, or uses of old technologies, or companies that want to do X, Y, and Z, and it's new, or it's polluting, or it's not polluting, or it's whatever, there's a regulation against it, and you have a public conflict, or, and that's the,
And so it needs to be resolved by all these different, in a sense.
Yeah.
And really the best advocates seem to be the ones or maybe the ones with, as you said, the most Nobel laureates in this, in a particular case that we're talking about here, but maybe the most money in another situation, or the most votes in another, where you're convincing the public, or an uneducated, or a non-specialized group, uneducated was the wrong word, I take that back, non-specialized people making decisions, because, in a sense, ultimately, that's who, I suppose, does, right, if you believe in representative.
Right, I mean, there's there are very few issues, or maybe no issues, in which, for example, commercial interests don't exert the maximum influence they can with large amounts of resources. You know, lobbyists in Washington, it's a big issue. I mean, I guess I felt like it was, one of my first exposures to this, or a close exposure to this of style, and I was a young man, and it was an education. But I don't think there was any. In retrospect, I don't think there was anything special about how that issue was
and,
played
we're
out.
Now looking at see how other issues are decided and whether they're about the health of the nation or you know, the proper way things get published or you know, one's interest as an academic scientist versus you know being a consultant for the next startup biotech company, right?
Right.
So, I mean, these are all issues. That
if anything, the public hearings in city council chambers were unusual.
Mm-hmm. You know. And sometimes they have their effect, right? If Cambridge had come down and said, "Nope, no recombinant DNA technology in our city limits," although I'm sure, you know, Harvard would have fought it, and MIT would have fought it to the, you know, to the very end, to the Supreme Court and whatnot, and, you know, federal legislation to you know, to combat the local legislation still, I mean, it could have thrown a wrench, and perhaps did for a while, into other people's larger interests than just the communities there.
Yeah.
But it wasn't something that disappointed you. I mean, it wasn't something that made you go, God, science is just like, you know, being in Congress or a bunch of, you know...
disappointed me.
You know, I well, to a certain extent, I guess, maybe that's my own buying of the myth that, you know, I'll assign an academic scientist to somebody who, you know, doesn't get really paid very well for what they do, and so they have to have some other kind of, like, interest in this, you know, I mean, there's some sort of idealistic whatever still left, right? And I thought
I can see
you...
the transcript now, laughter.
Wait, I'm going to change the side.